This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Richard Adey. This is Best Practice. Over the last 50 years, there's been huge gains in employment conditions for people at work. But an important part of the history of how those gains were made is in danger of being lost. Sarah Kane from the UTS Business School is hoping to preserve the stories of the women who stood up, challenged authority, and helped make work better for everyone. It's an oral history project, and she'd like your help. Sarah joins me now. Tell me what you're doing.
Well, it's a bit of a collection, and there's a wide variety of things that people have done. But what we're trying to do is capture stories that we wouldn't normally hear about sort of, for want of a better term, everyday women doing things at the workplace that make a difference. So that could be something, you know, just raising a very local issue, or that could be deciding to become involved in a wider issue that affects the industry they're involved in. So it's a sort of a wide range. But our main emphasis is getting the stories of women that we might not have heard before, collected and saved, I guess, forever.
Right. So are we talking about things like the introduction of maternity leave, or what? How big is the scope?
Look, the scope is going to be, as the project progresses, quite broad. But we feel like some of those big campaigns are quite well known. So what we're trying to do is capture all of the, well, at least a sample of the other types of battles and struggles that women have had at the workplace that largely remain unsung. So we're trying to bring those to light.
Do you think it's that we know more about what men have done in the workplace?
I think that's absolutely the case. I think that the history of the labour movement is largely a history of male struggle. And you can see that with the 20th anniversary of the waterfront dispute, where you don't see the stories of the women who were involved being retold. You see the stories of the male protagonists. And if you remember that Jenny George was actually president of the ACTU during that time, but we haven't heard about her contribution.
No, that's interesting. And it was only when the anniversary of it was coming up and she was mentioned, I thought, yes, she was.
Yes.
But I had forgotten.
Yeah, and she was quite pivotal in some of the sort of confrontations with Peter Reith at the time. And there was also the involvement of Hazel Hawke, of course, a much beloved woman in the labour movement who also came out supporting the waterfront workers. So these bits of the story tend to be obscured in the sort of cut and thrust of the male world of the labour movement.
Now, Hazel Hawke, who you mentioned, has sadly died. Some of these women, I imagine, are ageing. Are you conscious of some time pressure?
Look, that's one of the reasons that we decided to really try and make a go of this now, in that there are women who have made really important, pivotal contributions to what we all enjoy at work, whose stories will be lost. And so we feel quite a sense of urgency about getting to these women and hearing their stories.
So I'm imagining Jenny George will be part of this, yeah?
We've already interviewed Jenny, and that was wonderful, and she's been a treasure trove, as you can imagine, of other archival material.
But you're also interested in people that most of us have never heard of.
In fact, you know, we obviously want to talk to people like Jenny. We've also spoken with Meredith Bergman, who was the leader of the Upper House in New South Wales and the president of the Academics Union. But we're actually more focused on women that we haven't heard of, who have a sort of the unsung heroes, as I've said, because their struggles are more understandable to most women who have an everyday experience of the workplace, rather than the elevated position that Jenny did get to in the end.
Right. Well, let's hear from one of your interviewees, Chris Wagland. She's a cleaner who did a lot to help improve the conditions of her co-workers.
Basically, there was a lot of older cleaners who were being bullied, and basically they stood behind me and pushed me out front and said, Chris, you do it. A lot of them didn't have English, and so that was just petrified standing there, and they, look, we've got your back. But it's scary, it's horrifying, and you don't sleep, and you think, oh my goodness, what am I going to do if I lose my job? And of course, but you survive it and come out the other side. Mm-hmm. So we won our court case in the federal court and got paid what we were owed. Mm-hmm. So it took 2 years, right. And because of that, Wayne Berry, who was Labor member here in the ACT, put up a private members bill that gave us portability of long service leave. So, I mean, it was very much about not only raising our profile, but raising our opinion of what we did and how it had changed over the years. And the idea was to raise the profile and cleaners to have proper training, to be able to have the strength to say, my vacuum cleaner's not safe and I'm not going to use it. And of course, technically, you should have stopped working. I can't do my job, it's not safe. But you didn't. You nurse along a cord that was shorting out all the time until it, in the hope that you could get your work done and hope you could get a cord the next day, instead of stamping your foot and saying, no, it's not safe and I'm not using it. Because most people are too frightened. You've got to, you know, make people strong enough and confident enough that they will say, this is wrong.
So that was cleaner Chris Wagland. Sarah, what did she do?
So really what Chris did was she took a step to say when there was a change of contract and a company that was going out of business and she wanted to get the workers their entitlements that they were not going to get. And so she led cleaners through a court case, as you heard, to be able to retrieve some of those entitlements. And I think that the thing about interviewing Chris that stood out the most is... And Chris ended up, going to talk to politicians, meeting with the leader of the opposition, the cabinet ministers, all kinds of things. And she said to me, Sarah, most of the time my knees were just shaking and I just did it anyway. And she said, that's the one thing that I would say to anyone at the workplace is you'll feel terrified, but it's the right thing to do, so I did it.
The other thing that she mentioned was portable long service.
Of course, that's really important in an industry like cleaning, which can be, the jobs can change, you can, be working for different companies as contracts change. So that's a really key thing. And I think that's one of the narratives that comes out with these interviews is that often these women start with a very local issue. And then once they're involved, they understand that their local issue might be representative of something broader that's going on and they become involved in that broader campaign, which is what happened to Chris.
Was there any personal cost? Because I imagine that if you're not a Jenny George, if you're a kind of ordinary worker, and as Chris mentioned, it's not that she wanted to, she kind of got pushed to the front by her colleagues. Mm-hmm. You can imagine there being a personal cost for some of these women.
That definitely the case. And that's one of the things that we try to draw out in the interviews. What happened? Why did you do this? How come you took this decision to lead when others wouldn't? And the story that Chris told is that, of course, it took, time out of her family life. She had a family, she had children, so it took time away from there. But also don't forget that the key reason that people don't speak up at work is because they fear retribution from their employer. And Chris did have to face some rather, targeted behaviour by various employers in response to her standing up for what she felt were the rights of the cleaners.
Your oral history project uses as its starting point 1968, so 50 years ago, and of course a very pivotal year in much of the world, actually. If we compare then and now, what stands out for you as some of the most significant changes over the last five decades?
Look, I think we've made immense progress in terms of things that you mentioned before, like maternity leave. Of course, the superannuation system wasn't in place, although we all know about the gender inequities in it. So I think there's been quite a lot of progress in terms of course, the latest tranche, I guess, of positive change is domestic violence leave and the move to include that. And of course, the Me Too campaign and exposing sexual harassment in the workplace. So I think there's been a lot of really positive developments. But I think the thing for me that's quite instructive about these interviews is the similarity of the experiences of the women. So yes, you have, of course, you have progress in the formal regulation, progress in informal entitlements, but you have the day-to-day experience, which actually is fairly similar. Many women in low-paid jobs particularly go to work. They're not working in sort of high-tech, new technology areas. So the labour process is much the same. The experience of working under pressure in terms of the time that Chris was talking about is the same. Working with employers who are experiencing the need to reduce costs. Labour cost is a big cost. So those kinds of conditions actually haven't changed.
And in fact, for the progress that's been made, we've also seen this increase in casualisation. We've seen people increasingly forced to become more or less their own business. So they're out there with an ABN and nothing else. And that has pushed back conditions, hasn't it?
Very much so. That's been a very undermining force for conditions. And, I always say, you look at the overall conditions and, you'll find a woman whose conditions are worse. So in terms of independent contracting, in terms of casualisation, particularly casualisation, women, are much more likely to be casual.
Yeah. So you have launched a crowdfunding campaign. Tell me a bit about that.
So my colleague Kathy Brigden and I decided that this was really the type of project which we wanted to proceed with regardless of whether we had resources at the time. But we know that we need a minimal amount of resources to carry on and collect these really valuable stories. So we thought we would give a go. We would get modern and give a go at crowdfunding. And we thought that there would be probably a natural constituency of people who would be interested in this, women in the workplace, women unionists, women local workplace leaders. And so we put together a crowdfunding campaign in order to try and gather the resources to get as many, the way we describe it is to save these stories. It's really about saving these stories before it's too late.
Well, we'll put a link to it at the on the homepage for best practice, but just give us the address.
The address is at chuffed.org. So if you go to chuffed.org and you search up Save Women's Stories, you'll come up to our page.
All right, we'll definitely put it there. Are you open to suggestions from people who might want to give you some money but also know about a story that you maybe don't know about?
Absolutely, and this is, you know, this whole snowballing has been fantastic. So being put in touch with women who we don't know, as we said, we want those untold stories, has been fantastic. So all suggestions will be gratefully received. And you know, depending on how the crowdfunding goes, we'd love to get to everyone.
And I guess it doesn't have to be from 1968 or 1973 or 1982 either. It can be much more up to date.
It's much more up to date. Like, I've just been interviewing women who are currently involved in the construction union, which you can imagine is quite an interesting case. So to look at current involvement, and I think to have that scale, a scope across time, is also really interesting. Contrast, as you said, what's changed, what's stayed the same, is really interesting to find out.
Well, good luck with the project. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Kane, Associate Professor at the UTS Business School. And for more on her crowd-funded oral history project, Save Women's Stories, search for chuffed.org or follow the link on the Best Practice homepage at abc.net.au/rn. Board accountability. That's one of the water cooler topics while the Banking Royal Commission rolls along. How should boards be functioning so that they have a clear oversight of a company's activities, both good and bad? Not by appointing mates to the board, according to the woman you're about to meet. You'd think that was obvious, wouldn't you? And yet research by Shireen Smith suggests that that's what typically happens. Shireen teaches ethics and governance and business at RMIT, and her PhD thesis, still in the works, is evaluating board recruitment practices. She joins me now. Shireen, welcome to Best Practice.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard.
Before we talk about your work, just remind us of what we already know about the makeup of boards.
Studies have reported, and analysis by AICD shows a 80-20 percentage, females being the minority on boards.
Right. So that's the Australian Institute of Company Directors, 18% right. On ASX 100 companies, I think. I mean, it's barely moved, hasn't it? And that's despite a lot of awareness about this now.
There's been a lot of awareness about it. And I mean, governing bodies, organizational stakeholders have really tried to push this forward. But in Australia, what we have is a principles-based system. So it's not mandated. Right. So when you compare Australia to other regions like Norway, which have actually passed a law that actually prescribes that you have a minimum 40% on boards, in Australia, it's completely different. It's very discretionary. It's a comply and explain principle. So if you do not comply, you explain, you give reasons. And so this gives a lot of flexibility to persons that are actually structuring boards at the moment.
Now, that, I suppose, is the baseline. Now, you've been looking at something slightly different, haven't you? What have you been examining?
I wanted to find out, how did we get here? Because, you know, let's take a step back from what the composition is saying, but what do we actually know about board recruitment? And what you found was that there is a nebulous understanding of how persons got onto boards. And so, you know, my first focus was, how does one become a director? How do you get onto boards?
So you actually went out and talked to a lot of directors, didn't you?
So I spoke to 20 directors, and this range, and, you know, these are persons that have been on boards for as long as 40 years. So I had some very experienced company directors on various types of boards that were able to give me some insight. And what you found was there were two narratives that came through from those discussions. So when you ask persons, you know, how did you get onto board? You know, they'll say, I was recruited because of my marketing expertise or my accounting expertise. But then when you started to ask, okay, so what happens when you are recruiting other persons for boards? And then you started to get those idiosyncrasies that said, okay, you need to know someone, you need to belong to this particular network. You know, the board decided that we would rather have people we know than people we don't know.
Right. So that means that it actually limits your set of potential board recruits, doesn't it?
So it really is primarily what the study found is that board recruitment is done from a closed network, right? So the pool of candidates are very much limited. Whatever human capital that our qualifications that we speak about, it's really limited to those social circles or those networks that these boards are recruiting from.
What's the process then?
So the process explained to me is that when a vacancy comes up, the first thing that they do is they ask around the table, who knows someone?
Right.
And then based on that, they'll have an informal meeting. They'll ring up the person, have an informal meeting to find out, you know, their availability, their interests, what their skill set is. Now, there is some validation in all of that for skill set. But one of the things that I want the listeners to understand is that when you are recruiting from a closed circle, qualifications is relative because you don't have anything to compare that to. So you don't really know if you're getting the best candidate for the job. And so what I found is that conversations about qualification, it's more of, you know, using a legal term here, it's an ex post facto rationalization of recruitment decisions. So after the fact.
Yeah.
So if you put me onto a board, you know, my rationalization for being on that board would be that, okay, I have 15 years experience being an accountant. I have background in ethics and governance. And so that becomes the rationalization. But that is not the primary reason why I got onto this board in the first place. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I am the best candidate for the job.
So our board members, and you mentioned you talked to 20 of them.
Yes.
Is everybody comfortable with this process? Because it seems to be very limiting.
Well, the interesting thing about that, Richard, was that the female directors, they were more opposed to it, but then they are the minority on boards. You know, I heard coming through from the female directors was that, you know, we were opposed to it. We're not casting the net wide enough. And you also found that persons were actually allowed to stay on longer on boards than it was beneficial. So after a while, even that qualification or experience or expertise that you're talking about, you know, becomes counterproductive depending on what is going on. And this primarily happens because if they're not able to identify, you know, a suitable replacement within that particular network, then persons stay on longer than beneficial for organizations. So while the female directors, they have a problem, and if we back up a bit, we have a existing issue, you know, from the 80s that, you know, has really influenced what has been going on boards with these old boy networks. So you find that persons, you know, that have these associations from the grammar schools and all those kinds of networks and, you know, alumni, they have dominated, these males have dominated boards, and they have all these business connections and different relationships. And so this is where the problem started in the first place. And so now while you have that 20% of females getting onto boards at the moment, what you find is that they are not really influential.
I've actually had people on boards tell me that the problem with, I suppose, being encouraged to, being made to recruit women, being made to recruit people who are different, is that they don't have the skills. They're kind of saying they don't have the skills or experience. They're just there because we're supposed to be targeting diversity. They've actually said that to me.
Well, there's a bit of tokenism going on, because what you find when you recommend a principle or a rule, then there's somewhat of a checkbox kind of approach. And I found that in my discussions that, okay, we need to have 20%. And so let's check that box. But a focus, and, you know, I don't want anyone to misunderstand, it's very important that there is a focus on diversity, but it's how it's being done. Because what we currently have right now is a diversity paradox, what I call a diversity paradox, where you have, you know, studies and reports from the AICD saying that, listen, more women are getting onto boards and we have more skill diversity, but we do not have actual diversity, because all you're finding is this checkbox approach to make sure that we meet the minimum requirement. And so you're getting the females onto boards, but they are being recruited from these same social networks.
Right. So they're just as connected as the men on the board.
They are just as connected as the men. So you get this diversity paradox where you're not actually getting diverse boards by this approach. Now, I want to just make a comparison to what happened in Norway in 2007 when they passed that act. What happened? You know, so this debate that we don't have enough qualified female, that is not necessarily the case. When Norway passed that act, what studies found afterwards were that females that came onto boards after the act was passed were far more qualified than their predecessors.
So for boards and for the companies they're in charge of, the issue is not whether this is not fair to women or not fair to parts of Australia that are not properly and fully represented. The issue is, do they have an effective board? And the research is pretty clear on this. You need diverse voices.
You need diverse voices because, you know, boards have been dominated by this, you know, group think mentality. And I found that in the interviews also, that persons were very much concerned to go against the status quo. I have been told by several directors in that interview that diversity causes conflict. So we are much more comfortable with persons like ourselves. And this is the problem. So even though you're getting the females coming through, they are still from these same social circles. And so there is this understanding and conformance to the status quo. So no one is really challenging or changing what is currently happening on boards.
That means, I suppose, that if you're on that board, that you want a harmonious board, perhaps rather than an effective board.
And this is part of the problem, because we need to also evaluate what is the role of a board? What do they set out to achieve? I also found that there were so many different perspectives as what it is. And so the conversations have been dominated primarily by this profit maximization focus, this shareholder focus kind of thing. But we find that this is not working, because the governing aspect of it, the oversight, the risk assessment, all of those factors are not being taken care of at the moment.
Interestingly, if you look at boards in countries like Germany, they will often have scientists on boards. So somebody with a completely different perspective to the usual background, which is in things like law and accounting and running the business anyway.
And I'm happy you made mention of that, because a colleague of mine has been doing extensive study on the German system. And persons don't understand that there's an alternate model. So what we have is this one-tier board system in the, you know, the Anglo-English-speaking world. And in Germany and in Netherlands, the Dutch system, it's a two-tier kind of system. And what you have is representation from different persons. So you have a supervisory board where you have, you know, that's completely independent directors on that, employees, workers' council, you have a management board. And so you have a wider cross-section of persons, and you have representation from all key organizational stakeholders. And it makes much of a difference.
Shireen, thank you very much for joining me today.
It was my pleasure.
Shireen teaches ethics and governance and business at RMIT, and her PhD thesis is evaluating board recruitment practices. That's it for this week. Best Practice is produced by Murata Dias and Ian Coombe. Our sound engineer is Jennifer Parsonage. I'm Richard Ady.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.